Hello, I'm Representative Connie Bernardi, and welcome to the Higher Education Finance and Policy Committee in the Minnesota House of Representatives. Pursuant to House Rule 10.01, I call this remote meeting of the House Higher Education Finance and Policy Committee to order. The committee legislative assistant will take the role to determine the members who are present. Please proceed. Ms. Schmaltz.
Chair Bernardi.
Present.
Bernardi, present. Vice Chair Christensen.
Present.
Christensen, present. Representative O'Neill.
O'Neill, present.
O'Neill, present. Representative Albright. Representative Albright. Representative Daniels.
Present.
Daniels, present. Representative Erickson.
Present.
Erickson, present. Representative Hansen.
Hansen, present.
Hansen, present. Representative Heintzman.
Present.
Heintzman, present. Representative Howard. Representative Howard. Representative Keeler.
Present.
Keeler, present. Representative Cleavorn.
Cleavorn, present.
Cleavorn, present. Representative Kosnick. Representative Kosnick. Representative Kreshaw.
Kreshaw, present.
Kreshaw, present. Representative Mason. Representative Mason. Representative Meckland.
Meckland, present.
Meckland, present. Representative Noor.
Kosnick, present.
Okay. Kosnick, present. Representative Noor. Representative Sandell.
Present.
Sandell, present. Representative Sandsted.
Present.
Sandsted, present. Representative Thompson. Representative Thompson. Representative Albright. Representative Howard.
Present.
Howard, present. Representative Mason. Representative Noor.
Present.
Representative Thompson. And Representative Albright.
Present.
Albright, present. And a quorum is present, Madam Chair.
Thank you. And before we begin today, I just want to thank all of our members on our committee. I know I just want to recognize your dedication and commitment to your work here at the Capitol. You know, we spent two big meetings together yesterday, and now we are back here again. And sometimes it goes unsaid because of we just know that you're going to do great work regardless. But I just want to pause and thank each one of you for the work you do for our state. And I just know that you are appreciated. So thank you. And extending that to our staff as well. They put a lot of hard work in behind the scenes to make all this a go, as well as our partisan and nonpartisan staff. So I want to give a shout out to them and our Minnesota House Information Services that makes this possible to be able to communicate with the public, to the public. So thank you, everyone. I really appreciate your work. Today, before we move on to today's calendar, may I have a motion to approve the minutes for February 23rd, 2021?
So moved, Madam Chair.
Oh, thank you, Representative Noor. Representative Noor moves approval of the minutes for February 23rd. And if you want to take off your mute buttons, is there any discussion? Hearing none, those in favor say aye.
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 Those opposed? The motion prevails, and the minutes for February 23rd, 2021 are approved. Today we have the Office of Higher Education joining us to do a walkthrough through the office of the Office of Higher Education Policy Bill, House File 1181. I know that we have a number of new higher education members, and this can be a complex bill. So today we will be doing a walkthrough with the bill language in front of us before we take official action. We will pause to take questions from members at the end of each section on the bill. Walking through the bill with us today is Nikki Oliver, the Grants and Government Relations Manager at the Office of Higher Education. And Ms. Oliver, welcome back to our committee. And I just want to encourage you and others on staff to pace yourselves in how fast you deliver the information, because I know doing it at a moderate speed is helpful to me and likely to other members to be able to take notes. And I know specifically there's someone online who is super knowledgeable and is very fast at her delivery. And I just want to be sure that everybody just slows down a little bit so that we can all take in the information in this complex bill. So welcome to the committee and back to our committee. Please proceed with the walkthrough, Ms. Oliver.
Thank you, and thank you, committee members. Once again, for the record, my name is Nikki Oliver. I'm the Manager of Grants and Government Relations for the Minnesota Office of Higher Education, and I just want to thank you all for the opportunity to do a high-level walkthrough of the agency's policy bill. I do have a few staff on hand for questions that arise that are better suited to answer them than I am. So as those questions come up, I will call on the appropriate staff person. I would also like to acknowledge that we will have a few amendments that, when appropriate, we'll like to present to you all at a later date. And as I get to where we would like amendments, I will mention that this area will have amendments coming forth to you all as well. Won't go into details until you all actually have those in front of you. So to start off, I'll go section by section. The first section of our bill is related to transcript access. So what this section is doing is prohibiting institutions from withholding a student or a former student's transcript for unpaid debts on their account up to $1,000. This is one of those areas where we will have some amendments due to additional feedback from institutions. Withholding student transcripts for non-payment of student account debts is an established practice at many of the colleges across the country, including Minnesota colleges. However, evidence and research has shown that the practice is in fact detrimental to student success, and we've seen that through our Minnesota Reconnect program, where it was for adult learners returning to college who had some credits but not all. That was one of the barriers they faced, was transcript holds. When colleges withhold the student's official transcript for non-payment, the student is prevented from enrolling at, transferring credits to, and completing their program at another college. Students may also require access to official transcripts when applying for jobs. A student account debt or financial hold may result in a student experience a disruption in funding due to financial aid recalculations, financial emergencies, or other unforeseen circumstances. So we seek with this language, we're seeking to eliminate one of those barriers. And like I've said, we've been in conversation with many with these systems. We know for a fact Penn State is super supportive of this language. In fact, they're actually proceeding with their own policy to do away with the transcript access holds. I'll stand for, I guess, questions regarding this section, right?
Right, yes, and I just keep encouraging you to slow down, because we're here, when you hear slower than when you read. So do we have any questions on this section? I do not see any hands up, so we will move along to the next section. Please proceed, Ms. Oliver.
Thank you. Members, the next actually the next two sections. So section two and section three are regarding allowing for students to have reinstated certain financial aid if their family has experienced a serious health condition. Currently, as the law is written, it's only for if the student has experienced a serious medical condition. And what we've seen through COVID is a lot of our students are also caregivers to their immediate family, meaning it their children or their parents or their spouse. So we want to also extend that ability for those students to also have certain credits reinstated should they be experiencing, or a relative close family member be experiencing, serious health conditions. And I guess I'll stand for questions regarding that change.
Members, does anybody have any question for this part? Okay, Representative Sandell.
Thanks, Madam Chair. I just request that there's background music and it makes it that someone has on, and it's a little bit hard to hear. I don't know if anyone else is experiencing that, but if someone has a background music, would you just turn it off, please? Thanks.
Okay, please, yes, that would be very helpful. Thank you. Ms. Oliver?
Yes, I apologize. I had to be in a certain facility to make sure I could give my full attention to the committee. So the location I'm at has kind of music, so I will try to speak a little louder if that's helpful, because I'm assuming that's what they're hearing.
Yeah, Ms. Oliver, there's no way to get in to an area without that noise.
I can try to move if you
okay,
give me
well
one second.
Yeah. That's a lot to ask, but it will be helpful.
Is this at all better, Madam Chair?
It sounds like it might be. Representative Sandell, can you give the thumbs up? You're the one who specifically asked. Thank you very much. We appreciate that. Thank you, Ms. Oliver. You may proceed and please be clear on the section that you are starting on. Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I am currently on section four. Section four deals with some old statute language regarding income contingent loan repayment. And this just where, and so there's the option to completely repeal this language, but our staff and our agency thought that this would be an opportunity to adjust the language to allow for potential new programs for income contingent loan repayment programs, and that's what this change is doing.
Okay, Representative O'Neill, please proceed.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Yeah, I had a question about this. So this is statute that looks like the last application that could be made to the program was June 30th of 1995. So it's a very old statute. And when I'm looking through the statute, it basically says, so your old program, so this used to be an income-based or income contingent loan repayment program, and it was specific for things like school of medicine, dentistry, pharmacy, and the like. And now you're making it more broad so that it's really any school, any program. But you're also making it so broad that it's no longer the state of Minnesota residents. It's only contingent upon if you've actually attended or are attending a Minnesota school. So it's now it's inclusive of non-Minnesota residents. And it looks like the only requirement, as I cross-referenced it, was that you're enrolled in a Minnesota school, and it sounds like pretty much any school. So can you tell me, Ms. Oliver, what is the purpose of this, and how is that different than what we're doing right now? And so what are we doing, and why are we doing this?
Ms. Oliver.
Sorry, yes. Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Representative O'Neill, for the question. We're open to making that amendment so it is for Minnesota residents only. It is also so it's the same population as those eligible for the SELF program, if that is amenable to you. We just, instead of repealing the repealing the language, we just felt it'd be an opportunity to, as we develop and look into other opportunities for individual borrowers or borrowers in the state, that income contingent loans or income contingent repayment could be an option under by maintaining this language. So that's kind of why we were proposing it. It's not a necessity. Like I said, if you all seek to repeal the language completely, we're open to that. It's currently not applicable to any existing programs as is. We could apply it to SELF or SELF refi, but it was just an opportunity to allow for future opportunities in creating programs. So.
Representative O'Neill.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Yeah, and my question is, so if we're not doing this already, and this is an opportunity for new programs and capturing new people, as in non-Minnesota residents, so we're going to take Minnesota dollars to fund non-Minnesota residents. I don't understand what you're doing here and why you're doing it. And can you be more specific as to what future programs you might want to do? I don't like this change, and it just seems, I'm trying to think of a word that's not really blunt, but it just seems kind of sneaky that you're trying to like kind of sneak in this language, and you're going to start a new program, and you're going to include all kinds of non-Minnesota residents. I'm not quite sure what you're doing and why you're doing this, and it sounds like we have ample programs already in place. If that's not correct, let me know. But I need to know really, what are you doing here and why are we doing this? I don't feel like I got a very good answer. I want to be specific as to who exactly are you trying to target?
Ms. Oliver.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative O'Neill, we're not trying to be sneaky. I know it was a lack of better words. Like I said, we're open to making sure it's for Minnesota residents only. Very similar to our SELF and SELF refi program, we need legislative authority to do certain programs. Currently, SELF and SELF refi are not income contingent. So this language would allow us, if we had an opportunity, to make them income contingent programs or offer that as an option. I do have our SELF loan manager and our assistant commissioner of finance on the call, and maybe one of them could answer your question better as to who this would serve.
And Ms. Oliver, who would you like me to call on?
If possible, possibly Marilyn Kolger, or I don't know if Thomas Sanford would prefer to answer this question.
Okay, so Ms. Kolger, I will ask you first if you'd like to take it or defer to your colleague.
Madam Chair, this is Marilyn Kolger, manager of the SELF and SELF refi programs. I can provide a response, and then if Dr. Sanford wants to reply, he can also. We were just, as Ms. Oliver said, going to either repeal the language or look at making it available for SELF and SELF refi. The current SELF program does allow non-resident residents to borrow if they are attending a Minnesota school. So that's where the non-resident piece came in. If we were to utilize this for either the SELF or the SELF-REFI program in the future.
Representative O'Neill.
So I think I'm even more clear. So the SELF program right now already allows non-Minnesota residents. So again, who are we trying to capture by changing this language?
Ms. Kosher.
Madam Chair, we're just looking for an opportunity if we wanted to provide that as a repayment option in the SELF program or the REFI program in the future as a repayment option.
Representative O'Neill.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I would just ask that they would just include that in the self-loan program statutory language or make it more clear as to what we're doing, because this is very bizarre to me that you're taking a piece of statute that expired in 1995 and quote-unquote repurposing it so that we can now, I'm not sure what we're trying to do. So I would ask that you would just remove this section or repeal this section and just kind of start anew. So it's very clear what we're doing, because it's not. So thank you, Madam Chair.
Representative Cleaborn.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I was just, maybe Ms. Kosher could answer this for me. I heard her say that the SELF loans are already permitted to students who come to Minnesota and attend a Minnesota institution. And I thought I heard her say this would potentially allow those students to be able to refinance at this income-based level. Do we know how many of those students who come to Minnesota to study then stay in Minnesota as employees and make their lives here in Minnesota?
And Representative Cleaver, did you want to do that for Ms. Kosher or for Ms. Oliver?
Whichever believes they're the ones best suited to answer the question.
Okay, so I will start with Ms. Oliver, and then you can let me know where you'd like to direct it if you'd like to.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Representative Cleaborn. I think this might be a question we'd have to get back to you on. I'm not sure if Ms. Kolger or Mr. Sanford has that answer offhand as to where our loan borrowers end up long term. But if they do, I will allow them to answer. But I really assume we'd have to like follow up with that question.
Follow up would be fine. That would be fine.
Okay, members, are there any more questions for this section? Okay, and then Ms. Oliver, if you just proceed with where you are, the section and where you're at in the bill, that would be great.
Thank you. I am currently now on section 5, and this is related to the self-loan refi program. And we are pretty much aligning the refi program with what is currently in statute for the actual self-loan program. So removing the caps for those programs to allow for individuals to refinance larger amount loans. So that's what this section is doing.
Member Representative O'Neill.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So I, again, have issue with this part of the bill. I would be more comfortable if you would just give us a number that you want to change it instead of just saying that he now gets to decide what that number is. I think that's it should be the legislature deciding that. If you want to suggest a number, then that would be fine. We can discuss that, but just striking that completely and saying, well, we'll just let he decide what that number should be. I'm not comfortable with that. And so I'm wondering if you actually have a number in mind that we could discuss, but I don't think that we should just strike it completely and not and just have the agency decide what that number should be, I guess.
Ms. Oliver.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Representative O'Neill, we will definitely take that into consideration as we talk through this bill in future committees. I will say, my understanding is we probably wouldn't go above $100,000, but we are trying to make the program more flexible for these are individuals who have already borrowed money and probably, as you all heard yesterday, don't have the borrowed money from lenders or servicers that aren't very, like, you know, consumer friendly. So this is allowing them the opportunity to refinance their loans with a trusted state loan program. And we do have, as you all know, we get our funding from bondholders, so we will still be restricted in a lot of ways. So it's not like we can go off the rails with the capacity here. So I would like to make that note. I don't know if Ms. Kozier or Mr. Sanford wants to add at all.
Ms. Kozier?
Madam Chair, I just wanted to go back to just confirm that we are not doing refinancing loans to non-residents. Those are only made to Minnesota residents. So the in-school self program is to non-residents, but the refinancing is only to Minnesota residents.
Representative O'Neill, do you have a follow-up?
Sure. No, I read that. I understand that the refinancing is only to Minnesota residents. I don't have an issue with that. I have an issue with the fact that we are striking the number that's there in statute and giving the agency the authority to decide what that number should be. I think that should be a legislative conversation, and I'm more than willing to have that conversation, but I think the conversation needs to be had. My concern with Section 4 was that when you were rewriting this, you made it so broad that the definition says that you can include non-Minnesota residents in making these loan programs. That I have a problem with. So I think that needs a lot more thought. And honestly, if you're trying to redo the self loan, then let's go to that section of statute and do it there and be very clear with what we're doing. I'm saying Section 4 was very unclear, and that I think that that needs to be absolutely crystal clear what you're doing. So when you say things like, well, we want to change this so that we can do some program in the future and we can decide what that's going to be, I have a problem with that, because that should be some legislative oversight. So I oppose. I do not want to see Section 4. I don't want to see the changes in Section 5. They are problematic, and I will make sure that my concerns are conveyed across the other body, but I don't like those few changes at all. So I'd ask that you just remove them. Thank you.
I see no further hands for this section. We will move on. Ms. Oliver.
Thank you. Thank you, Chair Bernardi, and thank you, Representative O'Neill. We look forward to working through the language with you. I'm currently on Section 6 now. Section 6 through 13 actually is related to the dual training competencies grants. So the current statute currently requires employers to have an agreement with a related instruction training provider at the time of application. However, the statute does not clearly define which training providers are that can provide the training for reimbursement through the grant program. So we're clarifying that. The statute also states employees must receive an industry recognized degree, certificate, or credential upon successful completion of the training for dual training grant programs to be eligible under this grant. However, the statute does not provide a definition for what industry recognized degree, certificate, or credential programs are eligible for the reimbursement through the grant program. And also this proposal is looking to just clarify all of that and put in those definitions for eligible related instruction training providers, and clarify what programs and courses are eligible for reimbursement for the grant. And this also, per the guidance of the Attorney General's office, the agency is also seeking to make changes make these changes so that they're clearer. So essentially what's happening in these sections are we're putting what's already in practice into the statute to make clarification and make those definitions clearer. So I guess I'll pause. I'm sure Representative O'Neill has a few questions as this was a program she was involved with heavily.
Representative O'Neill.
Thank you, Madam Chair. No, I only have one clarification question because, yes, I did help write this language. So, Ms. Oliver, on line 6.10 through 6.13, you're striking language. And you, basically you're saying, so if an employee goes through this program, from my reading of what you're striking, the way the language is right now, it basically says that, you know, if you have some competency already as an employee of, say, a manufacturing facility, but you're getting additional competencies, that previous competency is taken into account. And I'm looking at this wondering if you're why are you striking this language? Because it looks like we're not any longer taking that into account. Can you help me understand why we're striking that?
Ms. Oliver.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Representative O'Neill. I actually am going to defer to Megan Fitzgibbon, who is the manager who oversees this program, and she can give more context as to why that language is being stricken.
Ms. Gibbon is who I believe you said to that I should call on. I'm looking for her name. Was that accurate?
Chair Bernardi, it's under O.
There we go.
Yeah.
Okay, it's behind, there we go. It's okay, and can you please say your name for the record? And I apologize for not catching it when Ms. Oliver said it.
That's fine. Thank you, Chair Bernardi. This is Megan Fitzgibbon with the Office of Higher Education. And thank you, Representative O'Neill, for the question. The reason why this particular section or statute language is being struck is because it's actually, part of it is because it's in a section talking about eligible grantees, but it's really talking about the training. And so we're just moving it into a place that makes more sense, into a place where we're actually talking about the eligible training. And when it talks about the competencies, that's actually also covered in the, trying to find it here, in the application section where it's talking about which competency standards the training is teaching towards or is training towards. And it's also in, it's in another part of the section of this statute that isn't, we're not actually modifying. And so it's, we're really just trying to move that part out because it just didn't make sense that it was in the subdivision talking about eligible grantees, but it was actually talking about the training that was part of the program. So we've just kind of moved it into other sections.
Representative O'Neill.
Thank you. Just a quick question. Where did you move it to so I can track the change?
I believe it's, and since your name is not showing, is it Finnegan?
Fitzgibbon.
Fitzgibbon.
Yep.
You may proceed.
Yep. Thanks, Chair Bernardi, Representative O'Neill. The 6.12 and line 6.13 part about the employee must receive an industry recognized credential, that is in, that's actually referred to in another part of the statute already that isn't being changed. I just have to find it in my things right here. That's in the section where we actually don't see it here. So I'm sorry, I'll have to go back and look at it, but I know it's in there. We're just moving it into a different place. I'm just not seeing it in front of me at the moment.
Representative O'Neill.
Thank you, Madam Speaker. Maybe they could just get back to me at a later time. I think that the underlying language that they're striking is really important to be in somewhere, and I just want to make sure that it is maintained and retained somewhere else in the bill, or I think it's odd that it would be an existing statute that's not in the bill. I mean, it seems like they've captured most of the statutory language about dual training. So anyway, if they could get back to me offline.
Chair Bernardi, sorry, I just found it.
Okay, Ms. Fitzgibbon.
Thanks, Chair Bernardi. This is Megan. It's actually up in lines 5.17, where we define what competency standard is and what eligible training is. And in there, we talk about that it has to lead towards an industry-recognized degree, certificate, or credential, and that it has to be training towards an identified competency standard.
Representative O'Neill.
Thank you. So the part that I was most interested in is still not, it doesn't appear in that section. The part that is, I think, valuable is to understand that an employee of, like I said, like a manufacturing facility already has a base of training that they have there, and it doesn't make sense to train them again in the same base that they already have. And that language allows them to sort of like test out, you know, they've already been competent in one area. They don't need to have training in that area again, and it allowed that flexibility. Unless I'm missing something, I don't see that in this language. So I would encourage you to revisit that to make sure that it is somewhere to give that employee flexibility. Because the entire reason behind this is to be very nimble and very flexible for an employee of, for example, a manufacturing facility or others that have a base of knowledge and have some competency, and that should be taken into account when they're doing their additional training. So I think that language is important. And if it's stricken there, it should appear somewhere else. I don't see that exact language in this section. So thank you. I just bring it to your attention. I think it's important and it should be somewhere.
Madam Chair.
Ms. Oliver.
Madam Chair and Representative O'Neill, the language is on lines 5.18.
Thank you. Okay, seeing no more hands raised, we can now move on to the private for-profit, nonprofit career schools changes. Ms. Oliver.
Thank you, Madam Chair. We are currently now on sections 14, and this is actually, so sections 14 through sections 23 deal with the private for-profit and nonprofit schools and the statutes governing them. Our office has done extensive work with the institutions and their CFOs on language in these areas. So as a reminder to, and as just to let some of you all know, because I know there's new members here, in the past few years, there has been a lot of school closures in this area. So what we are seeking to do within these sections are to expand on consumer protections. Would require schools entering into receivership to renew its registration with the Office of Higher Education within 30 days. It also provides a risk analysis process, and this is this section, and I believe that's section 17, the risk analysis. All the institutions had ample opportunity to provide feedback. We incorporated as much of their feedback as possible and to get this language in the condition it is in. Additionally, some of the sections I'd like to point out in addition to the risk analysis is section 16. So effective July 1, 2020, the U.S. Department of Education eliminated the distinction between regional and national accreditation. So this change is aligning that our state laws with what happened at the federal level. Section 18 pertains to records. And after the Argosy closure, it was apparent that there are academic programs that need an expanded definition for student records that are kept. Those programs that need academic documents for licensure, for example. This change is designed to add the definition that academic records that are needed in Minnesota for licensure must be kept by the student, like the rest of the student's academic transcript. Student records are important to students in order to go to college for additional credentialing, transfer of credits, and to gain employment and to receive professional licensures. Additionally, in these sections, there's changes for proration for those hourly schools to prorate student refunds. And that's what that change is doing in sections 22 through 23. And I know there's a lot within these sections, and I'm sure there's a lot of questions. So I do have Betsy Talbot on hand if there's any particular questions that members have about these sections.
Representative Daniels.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just have a couple quick questions for OE here. What type of risk analysis are you using? It's not financial. So to prevent another, school closing and kind of sticking kids with most of the debt there, how are you going to rate the college to know if they're viable and they're not going to be closing down anytime soon?
Ms. Oliver.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And for that question, I would like to defer to Betsy Talbot, if possible.
Ms. Talbot, welcome back to the committee.
Thank you. Sorry, I apologize. I needed to unmute Representative Bernardi and Representative Daniels. As you probably suspect, I can't actually prevent a school from closing with bad financials. And so what we're trying to do is implement an earlier monitoring system, so it's more iterative with the institution and starting that dialogue and saying, we've kind of identified some issues within your financials and some trends, or you've notified us of some triggers that require extra scrutiny. And so that we can start working with the institution to, you know, either have them start doing some sort of remediation or actual advanced planning for wind down. And so we have an auditor on staff. He helps us review the financials and make a determination of whether the institution meets the statutory requirements for financials. Then he also provides analysis if there's some sort of short-term or long-term risk with the institution. And then we share that with the institution so that they can provide feedback back to us. And they can provide us additional information and context with their financial situation or their enrollment to give us a better idea of whether there is a risk to students. And if we can't resolve that risk to students in that process, then we can start adding additional requirements with the institution that would protect students in the event of a closure, whether that be preventing advanced tuition payments for the future semester or getting transcripts and those student records on hand. But it's not a strict score method. We don't want bright line rules. We don't want to have unintended consequences. That's the feedback we received from our institutions who helped write this language, is to make sure that it's more communicative and long-term planning.
Representative Daniels, do you have a follow-up?
Yes, I have just a couple, thank you. Well, I didn't hear in that response basically any solid parameters that they're gonna use to decide, put restrictions on a college or any type of notice. So what I'd be interested in is what type of parameters are you looking at to decide if you're going to be talking to this college or not. So maybe if you can get back to me offline, that would be great. And then I know Ms. Oliver mentioned they had reached out to some of the colleges to get some input. I talked to somebody today that doesn't know of that happening. So could you mention, you know, the colleges that you spoke to that were okay with this language?
Ms. Talbot.
Thank you, Representative Bernardi and Representative Daniels. So we invited all of the private institutions, degree-granting institutions in our state to participate in something called a legislative working group. And so we didn't exclude anyone. And we initially contacted all of their compliance officials, and then they also invited their CFOs. So I can provide you a list of those institutions and representatives that we met as a group. And then I also have lists of, like, we had several meetings with four MPC schools. That's the Minnesota Private College Coalition, so that they could help, their CFOs could help us write this language. And so if there are institutions that didn't feel like they were able to participate equally, we're still meeting with them. But let me know, because, again, we tried to be as inclusive as possible in this process to write this language and have them help us lead it, because they're the ones who are going to be the most impacted by this language.
Representative Daniels.
Thank you, Madam Chair. That would be wonderful, Ms. Talbot, if you could both give me the parameters for possible school action and also give me the list of the private colleges that you talked to and the names that you talked to. I'd really appreciate you. Thank you so much. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Okay, seeing no further questions, Ms. Oliver, if you could proceed to the next section for college savings plan data, I believe.
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. Yes, section 24, college savings plan data. So this section is just providing a data sharing agreement between our agency and the Department of Revenue. Would provide certain 529 college savings plans owner data to the Department of Revenue, and the Department of Revenue would then match that data with the state's income tax filers and then report it back to our agency at a summary level. And the reason we would like to do this is we would like to see who is using the plan in order to improve our targeted outreach efforts. So if only people making $100,000 or more are using the plans, then we obviously need to do a better job at reaching the lower income levels and vice versa. So that is the purpose of that language. And my understanding is that there's, I guess, a clone bill to allow this language to go to judiciary at some point.
Okay, I see Representative Daniels. I'm guessing your hand is up for the last time, but I would want to call on you just in case you have a question for this section. Representative Daniels.
Sorry, Madam Chair, I forgot to take my hand down.
No problem at all. Representative O'Neill.
Yeah, just a quick question. Is the data deaggregated, or does it have specific data? Like you'd ask, you wanted to know sort of like income categories and who's utilizing that plan, and I'm wondering how specific the private data is.
Ms. Oliver.
Hi, so the data that our agency would be able to provide about the account owners to the Department of Revenue would be their Social Security and their name, just so they can match it with the income data. And they would just shoot back like the income data about the account owners. And I'm assuming it would be more summary level, like there's X amount of individuals at this income based on the information we send to the Department of Revenue. And if that doesn't answer your question, Representative O'Neill, I can make sure we follow up with you with the actual plan, the 529 plan manager, to give and provide more context.
Representative O'Neill.
I'm sorry, Madam Chair. Yes, thank you. Oh. That answers the question. I'm sure that you'll get lots of questions when you get to judiciary, civil law, data practices. There's folks over there that care an awful lot about private data remaining private. So there's got to be a really good reason to share data like that. So thank you.
Okay, so now we will, I see no further questions. We can move on to section 25 regarding the repealers. Ms. Oliver.
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. Section 25 are repealers. One is repealing some license renewal language for the private career schools. The language has to do with administrative rules and processes that are no longer applicable in the modern day. So a few licensed schools have Title IV aid currently, and it's just easier with online applications to have all schools on the same renewal requirements. So that's why this is being repealed. The other repealers are to no longer existing programs. So National Service Scholars Matching Grant Program language is being repealed. And then some language for the supplemental student loan rules related to SELF are being repealed.
Members, are there any questions regarding Section 25 of the repealers? Thank you, Ms. Oliver. Did you have some other remarks that you would like to make? I want to give members another opportunity to ask questions if they have any further questions. Would you like to make any comments before I ask members if they have any further questions?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'd just like to reiterate that our agency and our staff are constantly open to working with the legislature, and we're constantly working with stakeholders on doing the best we can for students and institutions in the state, and that's what you're seeing in this bill. And as I stated, we do have a few amendments we'd hope to see brought forth for some of this through a lot of our stakeholder engagement and feedback. And we look forward to working with you all and providing some of the answers that we can answer today to you all. Thank you.
Thank you. Now, members, are there any, does anyone have any further questions they would like to ask? We've got all these great resources here, and Ms. Oliver here to answer questions if you wanted to. Representative Heintzman, do you have any other questions regarding this bill?
Thank you, Madam Chair. You know, I think I have a question, and it might just be something that I will need to get feedback from OHE at a later date. But I'm hearing from my school that there is a change that could be coming that could change. It could alter who is ultimately responsible for canceling a class. From time to time, a student goes through a difficult patch. I'm not sure what it may be, right? But if, say, after that 14 days goes by and they have missed the opportunity to cancel that class, my understanding is that there's a change in this bill that would potentially require the institution to handle that paperwork and that responsibility. And I might not be describing it perfect, but I just wanted to see if that's something that maybe Ms. Oliver is familiar with and could give me some clarification.
Ms. Oliver.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Representative Heitzman. I'm not exactly sure what you're referencing. It'd be nice to know if the school you're hearing from could point directly to what language in the statute it's being referenced. But I'm assuming it's something within Betsy Talbot's statute, so she may be able to respond to that.
Madam Chair.
Representative Heitzman.
I think it's in lines 19.8 through 20.2. And the specific correspondence to me was, why would we put burden on the school to refund a student who has not attended class for 14 consecutive days and did not provide a notice of cancellation or make arrangements concerning the absence? That was a correspondence that I received. I'm not sure if that's triggering any of our testifiers today in terms of where that might be found and if that's a change that I'm getting good information on or not.
Ms. Oliver, do you want me to direct that back to you or Ms. Talbot?
Thank you, Madam Chair. So you're referring to the proration language. I believe Betsy Talbot may be able to answer that question for you. If not, we can definitely follow up with you, Representative Heitzman.
Thank you.
Ms. Talbot?
Thank you, Representative Bernardi. Representative Heitzman, this applies to our non-degree granting institutions who are already subject to a pretty structured refund program. So it's not your traditional degree granting institutions where students are online or things like that. Think of programs where they're on ground, students are having to physically go to class to learn programming or horseshoeing, things of that nature. So the faculty are very engaged with their students. And so this is just slightly altering the refund policy related to what happens when those students don't show up. The statute already had a provision related to what happens after 30 days when a student doesn't show up, but it does lead to some dysfunction when it's a clock hour program and those clock hour programs are like only on the weekends. And so we're trying to make it more functional for the school and for the student, for those types of hands-on programs where the faculty and the students are heavily engaged with each other.
Madam Chair.
Representative Heinzman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. If we're talking about a slight change, I'm a little confused by that. It sounds like we're completely altering the responsibility of discontinuing the class from the student to the institution. That would be a significant change, I would think. Am I misunderstanding?
Ms. Talbot.
They actually already had that obligation. So previously it was within 30 days. So how this worked in practice is that you have a student who's enrolling, they're there, let's say they're there for the first 5 days, they've been showing up, logging in, because these are clock hour programs, they have to log their hours. And then day six, they're not there, day seven, they're not there, day eight, they're not there. And suddenly it hits day 35, and that was the original statute. Day 35, they were required under the original statute to send notice to the student that they were going to be withdrawn due to a lack of enrollment of that program. And if they didn't want to be disenrolled, they would need to reach out to the school. And then the refund calculation under the original statute was from that day five. So they didn't get to keep, the school didn't get to keep days 30 or 6 to 35, they have to go back and refund from day 35 or from day 5 to begin with. So that's how it originally was written. And so our auditor, who helps work with our institutions in these refund policies, wanted to design it to be better for them because that 30-day window is a long time for reaching out to these students and getting a hold of them and then just closing out their accounts. We want to make it shorter so it's less harder to get a hold of these students and process their refunds. Then the schools have more clarity and knowing that student's not going to be enrolled and not waiting those full 30 days.
Representative Heinzman.
It sounds like there's going to have to be another conversation between myself and the institution so that there's some more understanding. I'm not totally clear on how this works, but I appreciate the opportunity to ask the question. Thank you.
Well, members, seeing no further questions, I want to thank members for all their hard work this week. You have reason to be tired, and it's Wednesday. You put a lot of effort in, and I want to thank you. Our next meeting is Tuesday, March 2nd. Thank you for our testifiers today, and we appreciate you being here. Members, have a great rest of the week. Thank you.